The lieutenant governor says he'd like to be a U.S. senator. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a Missoula City Councilwoman's harrowing day at the U.S. Capitol. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry learns more about a unique project to spread love, not hate, in the Flathead Valley. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Missoula Mayor John Engen about why he thinks buying the local water company is a good idea. Montana's Lieutenant Governor John Walsh is announcing a run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Senator Max Baucus in 2014. Democrats have been searching for a prominent candidate since former Governor Brian Schweitzer announced this summer he would not be running. His job as Lieutenant Governor is Walsh's first experience with elected office. The 52-year-old Butte native served 33 years with the Montana National Guard, including as a Adjutant General from 2008 to 2012. He left the Guard to join the ticket of then-gubernatorial candidate Steve Bullock. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce brings us more on the campaign that may be the Democrats' best shot at keeping the Senate seat in their hands.
I'm John Walsh. I have some news to share with you. Before I do,
Lieutenant Governor John Walsh released this video to answer what Montana political circles have been wondering about for months.
I'm announcing my candidacy to become Montana's next United States Senator.
Initially, the video was all there was going to be on the first day of Walsh's Senate campaign. The candidate was not giving any interviews, although that changed after numerous requests from the media.
These opportunities don't present themselves that often, and this is a great opportunity to be able to serve the citizens of Montana in another capacity.
Walsh says when former Governor Brian Schweitzer turned down a bid for Max Baucus' Senate seat, running himself was not something that even crossed his mind, but he was approached with the idea, and he says after really considering it and speaking with his family and friends, he decided he could make a difference, especially with the discipline and ideals of service above self he learned in the military. Walsh has been in his post as lieutenant governor for less than a year, but he says he's proud of what he has accomplished so far.
We've been able to balance the budget, create jobs, invest in education, and so we know that there's more to do as the Bullock-Walsh administration, but we also agree that Washington is broken and we could use more Montana leadership back there.
Governor Bullock's office says Walsh will continue in his post as lieutenant governor while taking on the Senate race. The Montana Democratic Party would not comment on Walsh's candidacy, citing a neutrality policy they observe with contested primaries. There is another politically unknown Democratic candidate running for the seat, Wilsall area rancher Dirk Adams. Montana Republican Party Executive Director Bowen Greenwood expects Walsh to be the Democrats' establishment candidate, but Greenwood says Walsh was clearly not their first choice.
In terms of politics, he's untested and really untried. He just rode behind Bullock for one election, and that doesn't make for the strongest possible candidate the other side could have.
At the moment, I mean, I think people know who he is, but know very little else.
That's MSU political science professor David Parker. He says name recognition may be an issue for Walsh, and tied to that, the ability to effectively raise campaign funds. Parker also says Walsh will have to contend with the fact this is a midterm election, which does not usually favor the president's party. For positives, Parker says Walsh's military experience will likely be popular with Montanans. The state has a high percentage of veterans per capita. And Walsh's lack of political experience, Parker says that could be just as much an advantage as a detriment.
There's very little to hit at the same time because he doesn't have that record.
Parker says the biggest question mark with a Walsh candidacy is how he will respond to the pressure of such a big race.
I mean, that's the greatest liability. He hasn't done anything like this before, and he hasn't been in the intense pressure cooker type of race that a Senate campaign is going to be, and we don't know how he's going to react to that.
The state's lieutenant governor may very well be facing a Republican opponent without that question mark. Congressman Steve Daines is widely expected to announce a Senate bid.
Steve Daines has already demonstrated he can run a strong campaign, raise a lot of money, and has built up some name recognition.
Parker says that would give Daines the advantage at this point. But Walsh and other Democrats will likely use the government shutdown as a campaign issue, and that could hurt any incumbent. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
To bring our values to Washington, D.C., where every Montanan knows it is so badly needed.
I'm John Walsh, and I approve this message.
Be sure to check out our full interview with Lieutenant Governor John Walsh about his run for Senate. Just click on this story from our website, mtpr.org.
And in other news from around the state, Missoula City Councilwoman Caitlin Koppel was among those locked down in the U.S. Capitol for about half an hour today because of that shootout near the Capitol. Koppel is in D.C. on city business to attend a walkability summit. She says she had just left Congressman Steve Daines' office to visit the director of the Equality Caucus, Brad Jacklin, and was in Colorado Congressman Jared Polis' office when the lockdown happened.
I just had walked in. It was probably not even 5 minutes, and a bunch of muffly voices were happening on the intercom system, and then a staffer came in and said that there had been gunshots fired outside the Capitol and that we were on lockdown. And so some other staffers locked the doors and told us to get away from the doors and windows, and we turned on CNN so we could see what was happening.
Koppel says she quickly let her family and friends know she was okay and posted that on social media. She says because of the government shutdown, the Capitol was already tense before the shooting happened.
The staffers that I've met with definitely seem kind of stressed out and haggard given all the stuff that they're dealing with the shutdown. And they're all getting lots of calls from angry constituents, I'm sure, on both sides. So I'm looking forward to coming back and just, you know, helping people resolve their pothole issues.
Koppel returns to Missoula next Tuesday.
A Polson man has denied raping and killing another man at Wild Horse Hot Springs, just outside the town of Hot Springs. CurAM reports 29-year-old Melvin Madplume Jr. pleaded not guilty today to deliberate homicide and sexual intercourse without consent in the May 26th death of 28-year-old Lawrence Kenmeal of Elmo. Prosecutors say Madplume initially told investigators that Kenmeal died after falling and hitting his head. An autopsy determined Kenmeal had drowned due to homicidal violence. Court records say another man told investigators that Madplume had made unwanted sexual advances toward him at the hot springs the previous weekend. Madplume is being held without bond, but his attorney has requested a bond hearing. District Judge Kim Christopher set a January 17th trial date.
Sanders County officials have released the name of a forklift driver who died in a crash on a western Montana mountain road. The coroner's office tells KERAM that 57-year-old Gary Wayne Beagles of Spokane died Tuesday afternoon when the gravel material handler he was driving went off a Forest Service road south of Plains and rolled down a steep hill. The forklift rolled over Beagles and he died at the scene. Officials say Beagles was working for Tice Electric in Portland, Oregon, which had replaced a generator on a mountaintop that houses several communications antennas. The rollover happened as the man was traveling downhill.
A grassroots human rights organization in the Flathead is building upon its anti-hate message, literally. Their group, Love Lives Here, teamed up with local artists and people from across the community and created ceramic tiles spelling out messages of love and peace through words and pictures. The first step of this project happened with the construction of a tile-lined gazebo in 2008. This month, the group is unveiling several tile-lined benches as an addition to the monument. Katrin Fry reports the rededication ceremony aims not only to highlight new benches, but also to refocus on the group's message of peace and civil discourse.
Woodland Park is a nearly 43-acre park in Kalispell and is home to many ducks, geese, and the occasional swan. It features a large pond. At one end of the pond sits a small gazebo with four posts covered in tiles of all different shapes, colors, and sizes. Co-chair of the local human rights organization Love Lives Here, Ina Albert, says the gazebo was built in 2008. Albert says the original funding for the project came from a woman named Karen Hilding, whose family had survived the Holocaust. Hilding had received money for what the family had lost, which she dedicated to building this peace monument.
The original concept had conceived that it would be a place to sit and to meditate and to meet and to have conversations about subjects that were meaningful.
Albert says local artist Kay Lynn worked with people from across the valley to create the tiles.
This was made by over 2,000 residents of the Flathead Valley. Kids, parents, whomever. But they all met over a period of time between 2002 and 2008 to create these tiles.
The artwork on the tiles ranges from pictures to people's names and phrases.
And some of them are just flowers, and some of them are words, and some of them say save the earth, and some of them say community spirit. And it's just really moving to stand here. And on the top of it, at the roof, they painted a sky, blue sky with clouds, which is really nice.
The four pillars of the gazebo didn't use all of the tiles created, and the Community Spirit Monument has recently grown to include four tile-lined benches in front of the structure. Albert says they hope to promote the values of respect, freedom, diversity, and safety. She says these values are fundamental for civil discourse, which is vital for a functioning democracy.
More so today because of what's going on in Congress and where the country is and people unable to talk to one another. What I think would be the wonderful, meaningful purpose of something like this monument with places to sit and places to talk would be as an example of talking together, being able to discuss different points of view.
Love Lives Here originally formed in the Flathead a few years ago in response to white supremacist activity in the area.
Started out as a grassroots organization to help the multi-faith coalition, which was also founded pretty much at the same time, to express the fact that we didn't want hate to be the dominant mood in the Flathead Valley.
Love Lives Here is now affiliated with the Montana Human Rights Network. The Community Spirit Monument is being rededicated on Saturday, October 12th, from 2 to 4.
Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful community citizens, I cry when I read this, can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
A tractor trailer hauling 290 pigs rolled onto its passenger side on an Interstate 15 curve in southwestern Montana, killing half a dozen pigs. Montana Highway Patrol trooper Brian Inman tells the Independent Record the southbound truck was traveling too fast for conditions when it tipped on its side near Basin at about 2 o'clock yesterday. The driver wasn't injured, but Inman says she will be cited for careless driving. He did not release her name. About 3 hours after the crash, one southbound lane of the interstate remained closed as crews rounded up the pigs and removed the truck. Inman said the pigs were being hauled from Augusta to California.
A public hearing will be held later this month before the Missoula City Council on a proposed ordinance that would give Mayor John Engen authority to open negotiations with the Carlyle Group to purchase Mountain Water Company. Carlyle, a global alternative asset manager, purchased Mountain Water about 2 years ago with the stipulation the city of Missoula would get the first shot at buying the utility if it ever went up for sale. In tonight's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Engen explains why he thinks it's important to pursue this discussion. And why now?
It's been about 2 years of nowhere. We've been continuing to have conversations with Carlyle about buying the water company since they purchased it from Parkwater 2 years ago. But because of their business model, because of the nature of their transaction, our ability and their ability to act in any way has been limited. So the timing is such that we found that we have a mechanism to begin those negotiations. We think we can have those negotiations in good faith and move forward. So the timing is really about a number of things coming together at the same time, and then me wondering, why wait? Let's get this going if we can.
And pardon my cynicism, but an election is coming up shortly.
You know, I no one needs to ever pardon their cynicism. Turns out I run across it once in a while in my line of work. And, you know, my old line, Ed, is that I don't get to be a cynic. I get to be a skeptic. For better or worse, I don't have enough control to contrive the timing here. And if I did, I would do miraculous Hail Mary tosses in October of every election cycle timing just sort of is what it is. There are no guarantees here. I'm mayor until I'm not, and my job here is to continue to honor this commitment that I made to the community, that if Carlisle bought it and we supported that sale, that eventually the city of Missoula would own it.
How have Mountain Water customers fared under Carlisle's ownership over the past 2 years? What's your estimation?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, so much of this today is about the local folks who are doing the work on the ground. And I think Mountain Water has a bunch of high-quality employees, and those folks are committed to running the best water company they can. What happens over time, in my opinion, is what really matters, and that is at some point there will be another transaction, or at some point Carlisle, who asked this cycle, I think, for about 5% rate increase and is getting considerably less than that from the Public Service Commission, will start to look at the bottom line, and that bottom line doesn't reflect investors' expectations. And so if you're not receiving revenue, you're often looking at cutting expenses, and I think those cuts to expenses affect employees and customers of Mountain Water. We operate on a much different framework. We are motivated much differently. And so while in the short term, I think Carlisle, through Mountain Water, has done a fine job of serving customers, and I don't think there's any change on the ground, in the long term, I think that picture changes considerably.
Last week, the Missoulian newspaper reported that Mountain Water's president said Carlisle isn't interested in selling to the city. That sounds like a bit of a non-starter to me.
Well, if the local manager were the person making those decisions, I think it would be a non-starter. And part of the issue with Carlisle is that the local manager isn't making those decisions. Carlisle is, and we believe we can have a conversation with Carlisle about buying a water company.
You've said that a potential condemnation process, eminent domain proceedings, should be a part of this conversation from the start with Carlisle. What's the case for potential eminent domain proceedings here?
Fundamentally, and I don't pretend to be a lawyer for all sorts of reasons, but fundamentally there is a question of public need and public necessity and public interest here. And I think, Ed, there is nothing more fundamental to the well-being of this community than air, land, and water. And our ability to control our sole source aquifer, our access to that sole source aquifer, is, I think, critical to the public well-being over time. And I think we can make a very clear case, and a number of lawyers have suggested the same.
And to those who say eminent domain proceedings are government bullying at its worst, you say what?
I say they are not. They don't happen often. We wouldn't take that sort of action lightly. That action would only happen after considerable efforts at negotiation, which I think are, I think we have tremendous opportunity there. And I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding that eminent domain is simply the government taking something from a private business. And in fact, the entity in this case, the monopoly privately owned water company, would be compensated fair market value for the asset. So it's not something that anyone does lightly or does every day, but there are particular cases that the law provides for. And the reason for that is cases just like this, where the public good outweighs the private interest.
You said a compensated fair market value. Fair market value, to say the least, that would be an expensive procedure. Lawyers, consultants, plus Missoula would be taking on an entity that comes well appointed with both.
It sure would. But, you know, Carlisle is in the business of making money. And if we can negotiate a reasonable transaction that satisfies Carlisle's investment, or investors, rather, there's all sorts of reason for them to want to be interested in that. You know, the interesting thing about working with Carlisle is there's a fundamental logic to what they do. They want to maximize their investment. So our job is to help them do that while simultaneously ensuring that they're not taking advantage of the citizens of Missoula as we work to acquire the water company.
So what are we talking about in terms of maybe just a straightforward transaction versus condemnation? What sort of money, and how would it be paid for?
You know, we hope that we have a straightforward negotiation. We don't know until council approves the ordinance. At that point, we're talking in the tens of millions of dollars. There are a number of ways to determine value. We'll work with some consultants to get there. And if we have an offer that makes sense to Carlisle, we'll also proceed with some pretty heavy-duty engineering studies to understand what the system looks like, what condition it's in, because we don't know today. And that's an important part of our responsibility as a function of this transaction. But, you know, I have to assume that we can negotiate a price that's fair and reasonable for all concerned and move forward.
We've heard, what, an estimated 40% leakage rate? Does that sound right?
We have heard that, yeah. That's the product of a 2010 report, which I don't have at my fingertips now. Yeah. So, and that, you know, that leakage is basically water that's pumped, goes into the system's pipes, and then disappears back into the aquifer. Fortunately, that resource is not disappearing out of the larger system. That is, the water is not being wasted, but there's certainly energy being wasted in moving that water around, and we do our best to make investments to start turning the corner on those leakage rates.
If that's right, at least a 40% leakage rate, is this thing a white elephant right out of the box?
You know, if it is, it's ours. And again, without a nonprofit public entity running it for the public good, the likelihood of any of that changing without significant ratepayer expense is pretty slim. What we can do is we can reinvest in the system. We don't invest in shareholders' dividends. We're not making anyone wealthy with this system, which leaves us, frankly, with what we believe to be millions of dollars that are traveling out of state today in overhead that we can put back in the ground to improve and maintain the system.
Okay, let's bring it in for a landing October 21st, right? Public hearing.
Yes, sir. October 21st, 7 p.m., Missoula City Council chambers at 140 West Pine.
Come one, come all, and it's certain to be a lively discussion, I bet.
I hope so.
All right. Missoula Mayor John Ingen, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
You as well.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until midnight tonight for the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains and the Butte Blackfoot region. Tonight should be mostly clear elsewhere west of the Divide, with some areas of fog and lows 19 to 26 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny skies in the morning, then becoming clear with some areas of fog in the morning. Expect highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. For central Montana, there is a winter storm warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 6,000 feet for Cascade, Judith Basin, and Maher counties. There's also a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Maher counties. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night and lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies in the morning, then clearing with highs in the 40s. And for southwest Montana tonight, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for southwest Montana. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the night and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies in the morning, which will then clear with a slight chance of snow and highs 35 to 45 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 39 degrees with cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 51 degrees. Butte has 34 under gray skies. Great Falls is cloudy with 42 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature is under mostly cloudy skies is 45 degrees, and it's 35 and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's also cloudy and 44 degrees. Libby has 50 with partly cloudy conditions, and Polson skies are cloudy and it's 49 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dave Ditlock.
As part of their authority under the Clean Air Act, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently released a proposal that would limit carbon emissions at power plants built in the future. New, efficient natural gas power plants would be allowed under the new rule, but traditional coal-fired power plants would not. This is an important step in addressing the threat of climate change. Power plants are the largest stationary source of carbon pollution in the United States. About one-third of all greenhouse pollution in the country comes from them. If we are ever to adequately address carbon pollution, cutting emissions from power plants must be part of the equation. Making sure that no new, dirty power plants come online is a good place to start. And start we must. It is becoming increasingly clear that our carbon emissions are impacting the planet in a myriad of ways. Just last week, the International Panel on Climate Change released its fifth assessment report. It is a consensus-based product of hundreds of leading climate scientists and is the most definitive set of findings on climate change ever published. The report's conclusions are alarming and strong. It found, quote, it is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of observed warming since the mid-20th century, unquote. The report goes on to state that temperatures will likely continue to rise, sea ice will very likely continue to shrink, sea levels will very likely continue to rise, and heavy precipitation events will likely be more frequent. Here in Montana, we are already seeing the impacts of the changing climate on our natural systems. Montana's mean temperatures have increased by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit since 1950. Of the 150 glaciers present when Glacier National Park was created 100 years ago, only 25 remain, and even those are expected to disappear within 20 years. Median snowpack in the Rocky Mountains has declined by 15 to 30% since 1950, and runoff is occurring on average 15 days earlier. As a result, we are seeing drastically reduced average flows in our rivers and streams, especially in late summer. In addition, warmer summers have resulted in a fourfold increase in major wildfires and a sixfold increase in the area of forests burned. And warming winter temperatures combined with more frequent drought have led to bark beetle outbreaks that have killed more than 3.3 million acres of Montana's forests. These changes to Montana's natural systems have an economic impact. Angling closures necessitated by high temperatures and low stream flows and public land closures caused by wildfires put a hit on our outdoor economy. Wildfires and beetle infestations impact our logging economy. More common droughts and severe weather events hurt our agricultural economy, and so on. In short, the changing climate has real costs right here in Montana. Given these impacts to our beautiful outdoors and our economy, it's disappointing to hear some of the same old tired pro-coal rhetoric from some of our elected officials. As an example, in response to the EPA's recent announcement, Congressman Dane said, quote, "This is a war on Montana energy, Montana families and small businesses, and Montana jobs, and I remain committed to stopping the president's job-killing agenda," unquote. Even if you ignore the obvious impacts climate change poses to our state and our economy, statements like these still don't make any sense. First of all, Montana already has a similar state law on the books that is even tougher in some ways than the proposed federal rule. As part of the 2007 law that re-regulated the state's utility industry, the state legislature passed a law that prevents the Public Utilities Commission from approving any new regulated coal-fired power plants that don't capture and sequester at least 50% of their carbon emissions, something that is not feasible at this time. If anything, the new federal rules would help level the playing field for Montana by making other states live up to the standards we already have here. Even more important than our state law, the economics of electricity are such that nobody's looking to build new coal-fired power plants anyway. The cheap price of the cleaner-burning natural gas is taking care of that. A new study revealed that for new coal plants to be competitive with natural gas plants, natural gas prices have to get above $7 per million BTU. Experts project that for the next two decades, the price will stay below $6 per million BTU. Economic markets are the reason no new coal-fired power plants are being built, not the new EPA rules. One last point related to economics and jobs. The new power plant rules will likely lead to a build-out of renewable energy sources. Studies have shown that renewable energy sources are more labor-intensive than traditional power plants. This means jobs. Montana has a lot of wind and a decent amount of sunshine. As utilities move towards more clean, renewable energy sources, Montana can position itself to reap the windfall and the jobs associated with it. In short, the proposed new federal rules limiting carbon emissions at new power plants are good for Montana. They're good for our climate, and they point us in the direction of the energy sources of the future. The EPA will be taking comments on the proposed rule. Please go to their website to state your case in support. This is Dave Ditloff, Regional Representative for the National Wildlife Federation. Have a good night.
Dave Ditloff is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Connor tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.